I'm Brandi Cruz. Today on Undivided, a new survey shows Seattle voters are deeply concerned about crime and homelessness, but will their ballots reflect that? And
I just can't do it today. I just can't.
What truly drove Councilman Andrew Lewis to vote against a common sense drug possession law? We'll take you through our futile efforts to find out. Plus,
you have no comment about children's heads being chopped off.
When silence speaks volumes. That and more coming up today on Undivided. You can support the show for $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We have a lot to get to, but I want to update you quick on a story we discussed on the show yesterday I'm very against allowing schools any sort of leeway to talk about, for teachers to talk about political issues with students. You'd think, this is why we can't have nice things. You'd think that functioning adults could have fine, fair, healthy conversations with students about the issues of the day. But I think there have been a lot of teachers, unfortunately, that have shown they can't do that. Because it's their way or the highway, it's their perspective or nothing. And so I just think you just don't create a slippery slope and you just don't talk about it. Because you have teachers who can't be professional enough to handle it. We were talking about the Bainbridge Island School District yesterday, how this is a district that has taken firm political positions on a variety of things. You know, when George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, related to, BLM and shootings and abortion, this is a district that has not been shy about telling teachers to engage with students on other political and social issues. But when it came to the terror attacks by Hamas, there was, and I'll just revisit it, there was an email sent out to staff from the equity curriculum specialist at the Bainbridge Island School District telling them this is not a time to argue about the politics of the Middle East. She said in the email that it was not her goal to justify or condemn any of the actions taken by Hamas. So it was sent to us by a staff member who said, this is very unusual. They want to take political positions and want teachers and staff to actively engage in political and social issues with students on a variety of other things. But when it's a terror attack, we're like, hey, don't argue about politics, Israeli-Palestinian politics. So we do this story on the show yesterday, and admittedly, we had reached out to Bainbridge Island, but it wasn't long before the show because it had been sent to us in the morning. So we did send them an email seeking comment before the show, but it wasn't a ton of time. So we had told them, hey, we'll, share your statement when we get it. What was really interesting is the source of this information reached back out to me yesterday and said, I think your show had maybe an impact because at 4 o'clock in the evening, so this is hours after our show aired and after the segment aired, the superintendent of the district sent out a very forceful email denouncing the attacks that happened. He said, the cruel and inhumane terrorist attack carried out this past weekend by Hamas has caused deep sadness and heartbreak over the lives lost in the attack on Israel. And so here you have, this very weak, oh, we're not going to talk about this, and I'm not going to condemn what Hamas did or did not do. You have this very weak email sent out to staff by this equity director, and then just so happens, 4 hours or so after our show, and after Nicole had sent an email asking for comment, now there's this really forceful email from the superintendent calling it what it was, a terror attack. But I just want to revisit, we also did get a statement from the school, but not till this morning, right, Nicole? So it had been quite a while, about 24 hours.
It's more of a response. That was the statement, because she actually attached that letter.
So. Yeah, I'm very confident that our criticism of them for talking about other political issues, but encouraging teachers, let's not argue about what's happening in Israel. I'm very confident that this forced their hand to send out a more sternly worded email from the superintendent. And then, so I'll just read, I'm going to actually read, Nicole, the email you sent, just because I think that it shows that they didn't really answer the question. But you had reached out and said, produce the Undivided podcast, da-da-da. We were sent a notification, sent to district employees by the equity curriculum specialist, and this is your overarching question, which mm-hmm. I think is a good one. Could you explain why this topic appears to be handled differently by the district? When is it okay to take political positions, and when is it not okay? That's a very fair, legitimate question. So you got a response back saying, hello, thank you for reaching out regarding the message sent to staff on Monday. The primary purpose of the email was to provide staff with resources regarding how to discuss the situation with students as they process the news and to be on the lookout for anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Yesterday afternoon, our district sent a message to staff and families regarding what is happening in Israel. The message is also posted on our website. And that was the message that we just shared with you. So it doesn't answer Nicole's question. When is it okay for that district, when do they deem it okay for teachers and staff to take very firm, forceful political positions on hot button issues? And when is it not okay? Because coincidences happen occasionally, but I find it unlikely that it is a coincidence that we did a story criticizing them for their response on this versus their response on other things. And then they took a more hard line message in the superintendent's email. So just thought that we would update you on all of that. Okay. Less than a month away from the November election, and it's an off-year election, fine, but it is a critical election, I think, for the state of Washington, because in Seattle, all 7 of 9 city council seats are on the ballot. I always think of Seattle as sort of a bellwether for what is the appetite of the state to move on from the current trajectory around crime and homelessness and substance abuse. But I have been covering politics in Seattle long enough to not get my hopes up. There have been many occasions in the past where I've thought, oh yeah, Seattle voters are going to vote so-and-so out or do a change of course, vote more moderately, and then they just don't, and I'm deeply disappointed. So I never get my hopes up anymore. But I also have seen repeatedly over the last 2 years polls and surveys that have come out that show that there is this increasing frustration among Seattle voters around crime, around homelessness, around the hands-off approach to substance abuse, around the low police staffing and the vitriol directed at police. And I just have to wonder, at what point do those survey results and those poll results, at what point do we see that reflected in ballots? Is this the year? I don't know. But the appetite, and this is a... I'll show you the survey I'm talking about here, because it's one that happens not infrequently. They do kind of a temperature check on Seattle voters a couple times a year, and it's commissioned by the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, and it's done by EMC Research. And I always like to talk about how many people they surveyed, et cetera, just so you can understand how the poll was conducted. So this is their fall 2023 index, which again checks the temperature of voters on some issues that are critical to the city. And they said this was done via live phone, email to web, text to web survey of registered voters in the city of Seattle. It was conducted September 14th to the 24th. And they completed interviews with 700 registered Seattle voters. The data is weighed by key demographic variables to accurately reflect the registered voter population. They do this in the spring and they do this in the fall. So we have talked about the results of this particular survey before, but this is the latest result. And there were a couple things that really stand out to me that think, okay, the voters overwhelmingly feel the way that I feel about these critical issues. So why are they voting for people who I would, and I imagine a lot of you would, never in your wildest dreams vote for? So there was one graph in particular I thought was notable, and it shows their top three concerns, the trend over time of the top three concerns of Seattle voters since at least 2021. That has been homelessness, crime, and affordable housing. And what you'll notice is since 2021, homelessness, which still accounts, it's still the top concern, but it's been trending downward, and crime and public safety is a second top concern, and it's been trending upward to the point where those lines on the graph are almost meeting each other. And I think that's because Seattle voters are coming to realize that they're the same thing, that homelessness and crime have such a tie to one another, substance abuse in the mix as well, that it's essentially the same thing. And I almost think it should be treated as the same thing. And then you see affordable housing being the third highest concern, but way down, only 19% of people who took part in the survey. Now, think about that in the context of how often you hear elected leaders talk about affordable housing. It accounts for way more of the conversation happening among politicians than 19%. I mean, they talk about affordable housing as if it's the panacea, the biggest single issue we face, but voters don't think so. They're looking at homelessness, crime, and public safety, and maybe they're coming around to the fact that affordable housing is not going to fix the homeless crisis. So let's look at some other results of this survey, because it's going to factor into some stories that we're discussing later today. So one of them is on substance abuse. And again, I'm like, who are these Seattle voters? Where are you? Please tell me that you're voting. Please tell me you're telling your neighbors to vote. Because this one asked the question, Seattle's hands-off approach to people using illegal drugs like fentanyl and meth in public is contributing to rampant street crime and is making it much harder for our city to recover. So it asked voters, do you agree or disagree with that statement? 81% said, yeah, I agree. And then to this statement, we should not enforce laws against public use of illegal drugs like fentanyl and meth until we first address the underlying issues driving addiction, like economic inequality, lack of opportunity, and inadequate treatment options. So basically the statement is, we shouldn't criminalize drug use. 66% said, I don't agree with that. That's the common sense response.
I think it's tricky how they worded that too. So just to check to see if people were actually paying attention, or right, maybe to sway them the other way.
Yeah, because it's worded in a very sympathetic way that you think a lot of voters would be like, oh, well, yeah, we should, you know, deal with economic inequality first. No, 66% are like, I disagree, arrest them mm-hmm. before you deal with economic inequality. There was another question on drug use. Basically how the survey worded it is it said they would read you a set of statements. Tell me which one is closest to your opinion. So statement A was the city's hands-off approach to public drug use is making our city unsafe. Illegal drug users need to be offered treatment first, but if they refuse, they need to be arrested and prosecuted. Or statement B, arresting people for addiction is a return to the failed war on drugs approach. So 71% said they agree with the statement, more so, that you should prosecute drug crimes if someone refuses treatment. And only 27% said, don't do that. That's a return to the war on drugs.
Oh, that's 27%. Really?
It's still a lot. Still a lot. Those 27% only read The Stranger. Mm-hmm. And then there was a question on police officers. To the statement, hiring more police officers should be an immediate priority for the city, 74% say they agree. 26% said they disagree, and I don't know what kind of rich enclaves they're living in, but talk about privilege. Y'all want to talk about white privilege. Something tells me I know who answered the 26%. And then to the statement, I trust the Seattle City Council to reform the Seattle Police Department without endangering public safety. 75% said they disagree. They're like, yeah, you guys want to reform policing, but you can't do that without making us deeply unsafe in our communities. So I think the thing that really gets me is, and this is not the first survey that has reflected those sentiments. And then it's like, well, what happens come election time? And so there's this complete disconnect between what surveys and polls show Seattle voters value, what they care about, what they want city government to do, versus who they ultimately vote for. And don't get me wrong, I realize that in a lot of these cases, it's sort of the lesser of two evils. You've just got a bunch of different shades of blue. It's like, you can vote for a socialist or a progressive, you know? And I get it that I would probably not be satisfied with I'm not a Seattle voter anymore, but with the vast majority of candidates on the ballot. But there are clearly candidates who value public safety more than others. And I would also say that if those survey results truly reflect the sentiments of the voting populace, that there should not be a single incumbent who gets their job back. There should not be one incumbent allowed to keep their job that has contributed to the environment that we're currently in around crime and public safety. And the reason I think we all need to care about this, even if you don't live in Seattle, is what happens in Seattle infiltrates out to the surrounding areas. Those policies find their way to Olympia. And then you've got the eastern side of the state stuck with state laws that are reflective of Seattle values. So absolutely getting Seattle to just take a little course correct in the right direction is critical. And we're a month away from finding out whether they're capable of doing that. Speaking of Seattle, our friend Jason Rantz had some updated numbers today on the state of police staffing, and it's not good. And there were some other outlets, Como News, I think, had an article. Yeah, here it is. Seattle police staffing hits lowest level since 1991, despite recruitment efforts and city investment. They said the city started offering hiring bonuses of up to $7,500 for new recruits and $30,000 for experienced officers. So those are laterals. But SPD data shows more officers have left than have been hired since last year. Is this a surprise to anyone? Our friend Jason Rantz, who he's always got his finger on the pulse of the ebb and flow of officers leaving versus the amount who are being recruited. He said in an exclusive tweet this morning, Seattle Police Department lost 4 more officers in September, bringing total separations this year to 78. It only hired 3 more recruits for a 2023 total of 49. Since 2020, SPD lost around 600 cops. Mayor's recruitment and retention plan is still largely offline. So here you have a department that continues, even 3 years after the summer of love, continues to lose officers at a rate that far outpaces how they're able to, how many they're able to recruit. And so this situation is not going to get better anytime soon. And I actually had somebody in the comments yesterday ask me what the summer of love was. They're like, what am I missing? Did I miss something? What's the summer of love?
You did miss something.
Yeah. Sorry, I shouldn't assume. I just say summer of love. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin in 2020 during the riots and the Capitol Hill occupied protests called it a summer of love.
Right.
And so we have made fun of that statement ever since because it was very much not a summer of love.
Right. I do think that it's typical that the money, the bonuses is all that they quote as their idea for getting cops to come back to work, right? Yep. Which that is so typical of maybe liberals to just throw money at the problem.
Yeah.
And instead, there's no environmental changes for these officers. They still are not working in conditions that they should be working in, and they are not respected by the council or anybody else, or not shown any respect.
Right.
And yeah, so I think it's just so typical to throw money at the problem, say, we don't know why it's not working. We're trying. Yeah.
And I think Bruce Harrell has tried at least to message more in a more supportive manner to police. Mm-hmm. I want to give him credit for that because I think he also acknowledged on the campaign trail when he was running for mayor that he felt like police had been unfairly disrespected. And I give him a lot of credit for that. And I think as a black man who's lived in the city for a long time, that actually meant a lot coming from him, I think, to certain communities. So I will give him credit for that. However, you cannot buy an officer's conscience, their sense of self-worth for $30,000. You can't buy it for $100,000. I mean, that is not worth it to them to be in a political environment. And I say that having spoken to many of them, and I've done interviews with officers who left for other agencies in the state where they felt like they would be more valued, but they're making far less money. Far less money. And they uprooted their family to do it. So that shows you have these officers who are willing to move on from careers and a trajectory that they've been on for 10 years or more. And so, no, you can't buy it. I mean, it's a nice incentive if someone's on the fence, but I just don't think that it's...
They've got to change the culture.
They've got to change, not the culture of policing. Is policing perfect? No. But they have to change the culture at Seattle City Hall.
Exactly. And maybe SPD too, because I've heard things within the department that don't sound great. So I think that there's a big overhaul that needs to happen, and it's not just throwing money at the problem.
No, I agree. And when you have so much and so often, this obsessive focus with the optics of doing your job. Like, I've said it before. I don't think police are above reproach. I don't think that they're above criticism. It's very important that they are held accountable for what they do and what they do wrong because they have a badge and a gun. They can take someone's life. They can take someone's freedom. And so, of course, they need to be held accountable. But at the same time, when you have this and you're living under this cloud of every single thing you do is under a political microscope, can you imagine doing your job in that way? I mean, that and then you're trying to make life and death decisions in the moment where your life might be in jeopardy. And you're worried in the moment when you're trying to decide, what do I do to save my life, to save someone else's life? And you have to also simultaneously think about the political ramifications and whether you will be politically persecuted. How do you do that? I wouldn't want to do that. I can't imagine that a lot of people would want to be put in a position where they have to make life or death decisions while also worrying about being politically persecuted for what they do. That's insane. I don't blame these officers. It's not a surprise that Seattle's in the position that it's in now, and it will take decades to undo it. Decades. But this was what that far fringe in left Seattle wanted. This is what they wanted. You know, they didn't actually defund the police, but they defunded the police through their words and actions and creating an environment that was so utterly toxic that they knew police would not want to stay. That far fringe of activists who wanted to and want to completely dismantle the criminal justice system and come up with policing alternatives. Well, now we have no choice but to be coming up with policing alternatives because there's not enough police officers to do the job. Insane. This is exactly what they wanted. It's exactly what they're getting. It's not a surprise. Coming up next, speaking of the city of Seattle, I have been putting this one in my pocket for a while, because I wanted to give the city of Seattle the benefit of the doubt, but there has been a public records request we have been urgently trying to get our hands on before the November 7th election. And the timing of this request and the timing of the city's response to this request is highly suspicious to me. highly coincidental. We'll get to that coming up next. But first, we've been talking about our friend Wes Jones, wonderful real estate agent in our area. If you're thinking about selling your home, but you have some questions first, which makes sense because for a lot of people, their home is their biggest asset and it's a huge decision to put it on the market. If you've been thinking about selling your home, check out a few real estate agents, but also reach out to Wes Jones. Go to sellwithwes.com. He came into the studio and talked about the first steps that he would take you through if you are thinking about listing your home.
Oh, I think the first step is having an idea of maybe what your home is worth, you know, and having that kind of baseline home value. And that's something that we can do complimentary. You can go to the website, sellwithwes.com. You just plug in your address and we'll get you a value range. And if you want, and if you're serious, you know, I'll come out and do a quick, you know, market analysis for you. That's all complimentary. And then at that time or another time, we could walk through the basic steps of what it would take to get your home ready for the market.
Yeah. And he also has a couple of really innovative tools that he can talk you to about. A lot of people need to do some work on their home before they put it on their market. They can help with that. It's called their Listing Boost Concierge Service. So visit sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Start by simply using their home value calculator. Plug in your address. Find out how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. The city of Seattle has yet to respond to a records request that I submitted all the way back in June. And I can't help but think that the timing of their failure to respond to it in a timely manner is a little bit suspicious. Let's get to it in our segment, Unbelievable. So you might recall back at the beginning of June, there was a vote in the Seattle City Council to pass a common sense ordinance that would finally allow Seattle police officers to arrest people for drug possession and open air drug use. Common sense stuff. There were enough city council members going into it the day of the vote for everyone to believe that it was going to pass, which was great. Given the drug crisis, Seattle is not only the epicenter of the fentanyl crisis in Washington state, but the entire country. I mean, we have, you know, on this record pace for deaths from overdoses. And so everyone thought, well, of course, the city council would give police tools to be able to actually intervene, save people's lives. And yes, maybe they have to spend a few days in jail. So anyway, we're all thinking day of the vote that this thing is going to pass. And then at the last minute, I mean, he had told people hours before that he was going to vote for this thing. At the last minute, Councilman Andrew Lewis, who is running to keep his job, who is the councilman for downtown Seattle, cast the deciding no vote.
I came out here on the dais today fully prepared to vote for this measure, because I do think it is generally proper that we reconcile our SMC to the state law. But with the ending of community court, without any additional process, I just can't do it today. I just can't.
Yeah, and with that, Andrew Lewis was celebrated by the far-left fringe activists who were in the room. And I said at the time, the only reason he changed his mind is because people came in the room, activists, and they screamed loud and whined, and he gave in. That was really my belief at the time. And last night, actually, Andrew Lewis had a debate with his opponent, Bob Kettle, and he offered a different explanation as to why he changed his vote at the last minute.
The only reason I was going to vote for that bill in June, Scott, and I'll just be completely candid, I was going to vote for that bill in June for political expediency. I knew it was a bad bill.
So he says, oh, I was going to vote for it because it was the politically good thing for me to do in an election year, but I knew it was a bad bill. Which, do you think that makes you look good? Do you think that makes you look good? You're saying, I'm going to be candid. I was going to vote for that knowing it was a bad bill because I wanted to win an election. No, that doesn't make you look good. I also don't believe that excuse either, because it just doesn't make any sense, because If you're going to vote for political expediency and then you turned around and supported an even worse bill, which last night he talked about the even worse bill he ended up supporting, which requires officers to jump through all of these hoops and prove that someone's a danger to other people before they arrest them for substance abuse. Here's what Andrew Lewis said last night about that bill.
He had just gone forward with the assumption in June that we could arrest everyone, put them in jail and remand into a court. That's not going to work. That's not effective. That is not something that I could go to the people of Seattle and say was actually going to make a discernible difference in our community.
Yeah, and that doesn't make any sense either. And now you're saying a weaker bill that you supported will make more of a difference. So nothing Andrew Lewis has said, nothing he has done when it came to his decision to kill that drug possession bill, to be the deciding vote to kill that bill back in June. Nothing makes sense. Add that, all of that, on top of the fact that I don't trust the guy. This is a guy who pledged to defund the Seattle Police Department by 50% in 2020. And he did that just 6 months. I think we have the clip. 6 months after saying this.
We need to hire more police officers in the city. I see on a daily basis that there's parts of our city where we don't have the staffing numbers to have effective community policing strategies and deter the kinds of crimes of opportunity that are prolific.
Yeah, so this is a guy who has no moral compass, no ideological compass. You don't know on any given day where he's going to land. So me, I'm like, okay, what? How could we find out if there was really anything else going on behind the scenes that led to him changing his vote on such a consequential issue in the middle of an election year at the last minute? So we ended up at the end of June, June 21st, I filed a public records request. And this is what that public records request was for. I filed a request, and it was very narrow in scope. It covered only a 10-hour period on June 6th, the day of the vote. So I wanted from between 12 p.m. and 10 p.m. I will read you my exact request. All text messages sent to and from Councilman Andrew Lewis's city-issued cell phone. All voicemails left on Councilman Andrew Lewis's city-issued cell phone. A list of calls ingoing and outgoing from Councilman Lewis's city-issued cell phone, and all emails, including any email attachments, sent to and from Councilman Andrew Lewis's city-issued email. Because what I wanted to see is, were there any outside forces at play? Were there any outside influences at the last minute who texted him, who called him, that got him to change his mind on such a consequential vote? So I filed that on June 21st. Here's the response I got from the city. It was basic. It just repeated what my request was. And then it said, we anticipate that we will be able to provide the requested records or a first installment of records on or about August 18th, 2023. So they were saying it's going to take about 2 months to get you a first installment of records responsive to your request. And they estimated they would get me those records on or about August 18th. Which at the time seemed a little suspicious to me. Why? Because that would be after the primary election and Andrew Lewis would be on the primary ballot. It also seemed odd to me because I've done probably hundreds of public records requests in my career. And I have never had a request for records as narrow as that take so long. I thought even 2 months seemed to be a little bit egregious considering I was looking for something so specific during such a narrow period of time. So August comes around. At the end of August, August 24th, they did respond with a few records, a first installment. And it was really just kind of worthless stuff. Basically, what they gave me is some emails that had come into the generic city council email with constituents complaining about Andrew Lewis's vote. That's all I got in that August records. And at the time, they updated me again on the timeline for providing more records subsequent to my June 21st request. They said, hi, Brandy, the records being made available to you at this time are records collected in search of Councilman Lewis's emails. We've reached out to the councilman's office for further records. We still have records to review and anticipate that the next installment of records will be available on or about November 10th. Now, what is suspicious about that? Well, of course, the general election is November 7th. So here you have, call me a conspiracy theorist, but here you have a public records request from a member of the media that is trying to determine whether there was inappropriate outside influence in the decision by Andrew Lewis to kill a drug possession bill that up until hours before the vote, he was in favor of, he was in support of. They tell me that the first installment is going to be available after the primary election and that the subsequent installment is going to be available after the general election. And now you might think, well, maybe those are just two coincidences. But again, I go back to I have filed hundreds of public records requests, hundreds. Most of them are very broad. Most of them encompass months or even years of records where I'll reach out to an agency and say, I want all emails from this year on this subject. Thousands of emails. And they respond to those requests in a shorter period of time. this is a request for 10 hours of records specific to one councilman, specific to one day, on one subject. And now fast forward to a week and a half before ballots come out to voters, and we have still not gotten any sort of pertinent records from the city of Seattle. And I have pushed back, by the way. I have emailed them and said, this seems unusual. This seems like an unusually long period of time. I've been told that they're short a public records person, that they have an opening in that department. But again, and look, there might not be anything there. We might get all of these records and it might be nothing other than Andrew Lewis is just a coward. And he responds to whoever shows up and yells the loudest. And it could be exactly what I thought it was at the beginning and nothing untoward. That's entirely possible. But we don't know. And in the absence of information, in the absence of these public records, I am only left to question and to wonder whether someone is making an effort to delay the release of those records to us until after the general election. So we will keep you up to date on that, but it is simply unbelievable. All right. If you're like me, you work hard for what you have, and you want to make sure that it's properly insured. That was the situation Mike and I were in the spring. We knew we were really underinsured. So when First Mark Insurance had approached the show about potentially being a sponsor, Mike and I are like, why don't we do the First Mark Challenge and see if First Mark can get us better insurance, can save us money, both. So we did the First Mark Challenge. We got way better insurance for the same price. It was a no-brainer for us. So we're now members of the First Mark family. Dave Taylor is the CEO of First Mark, and he talked to us about what he hopes you can get out of the First Mark Challenge.
One of our goals that we say is that we believe everybody deserves to feel confident about their insurance. And so that's really one of our primary drivers of those conversations is we don't expect you to remember everything we talked about, but we hope that at the end of that process, you're going to feel confident that you have what you need and also confident that if you have a question, someone's going to pick up the phone and take care of it for you down the road.
Yeah, I'm confident that they're just going to give you their honest advice. I mean, I've heard from subscribers who did the First Mark Challenge, and at the end of it, First Mark came back to them and said, hey, you actually have great insurance. You don't need us, which I think is a really good measure of an honest company. So try the First Mark Challenge. Doesn't cost you anything, just a little bit of time. You can do it virtually. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you. Okay, dipping outside of Washington State, we are going to talk about some of the real blunders when it comes to political and media reaction to what's happening in Israel. But I wanted to just really quickly go down to Portland because there's this horrifying story. And this is the kind of stuff where I'm like, how can people not vote for change? How can they not vote for change given what's happening on our streets? So there was a mass overdose in the Pearl District in Portland, specifically in a park in the Pearl District. According to KGW Channel 8, mass overdose at Pearl District Park, the most Portland fire has seen during a single call, officials say. They said 8 people overdosed near the North Park blocks. 4 were taken to the hospital. Portland Fire said they were all in their late teens or early 20s. And so you absolutely have, and we've discussed this before, you have the drug crisis that is touching every facet of society, old, young, people who are homeless, not homeless, people who are, for all intents and purposes, just, you know, I know I've talked to parents whose kids, you know, maybe they bought a pill on TikTok, which I know they shouldn't be doing, but who can control everything their child does? And it turns out to actually be fentanyl, and they die from it. And so, you know, it's not a matter of, I just don't understand how this is a politically divisive issue. I don't understand how it's a politically divisive issue to absolutely throw every resource we have at interrupting the drug dealers, at holding the drug traffickers accountable, and at, yeah, sometimes arresting people, getting them off the streets, getting them out of the depth of their addiction, and giving them a couple days in jail to really think about what they're doing and think about the risk that they're putting themselves at. So just horrible news out of Portland, but not particularly surprising. Okay, a few stories on the terror attack in Israel. The New York Times, there have been some real media blunders. The New York Times had a headline that's being criticized, and the New York Times ended up changing it, refusing to call Hamas terrorists, which by any standard, any definition, they're terrorists. And so the New York Times had this headline. It was, Hamas leaves trail of terror in Israel. And then in it, they referred to witness accounts of the massacre of civilians by Hamas terrorists. Okay, that's fine. This is a great headline.
It happened the other way around.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay, gotcha.
So they have a headline that seems completely appropriate.
Yes.
But then they changed it. And people are like, well, why would they change it? Because what they changed is they said, eyewitness accounts of the massacre of civilians by Hamas gunmen. What would be the reason, the rationale, mm-hmm. for the New York Times calling Hamas terrorists and then specifically going in and changing that one word? Now, had the headline originally said Hamas gunmen, I wouldn't have thought really twice about that.
Right.
But it's the change from terrorist to gunmen that has people truly baffled. And there have been a lot of examples of that in the media. There's another tweet that is getting a lot of attention, which I just cannot understand why anyone still supports or gives money to BLM. Can't understand it. You have to be able to bifurcate the phrase Black Lives Matter, which I think we all believe that, of course, Black Lives Matter in this country, and the entity that has become a complete and absolute scam. So BLM Chicago puts out, and they now take, Nicole, they've deleted it now, right?
It's been taken down.
Appears that way. So they sent out a tweet. It just had a picture. It says, that is all that it is. And it was a picture saying, I stand with Palestine. And it had the outline of what looks to be a Hamas terrorist parachuting in. And we know that that is how Hamas terrorists entered the music festival in southern Israel, where they opened fire, murdered concert goers, raped women who were there, is they parachuted in to commit unspeakable acts of terrorism, unspeakable acts of brutality. So here you have BLM Chicago saying, I stand with Palestine specifically. I stand with the Hamas terrorists who parachuted in to a music festival where they brutalized, murdered, raped innocent people. I mean, if this isn't example number 1,200,064, why you shouldn't support Black Lives Matter as an entity, I don't know what else is. All right, now on to the squad and Rashida Tlaib.
Really quick, an update on the New York Times. They've changed it back to terrorists.
Oh, now it's back to terrorists?
Yeah. I don't get the confusion they're having there.
I don't get the real problem they're having, just calling terrorism. At what other point in history have we had an issue calling terrorism terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
At what point in history has it been so controversial to call terrorists terrorists?
Or maybe they wanted to throw in guns, so you're more scared of guns.
That's why you're here, Nicole. That could be it, too. So there is a video that has been making the rounds. Jackie Heinrich, who's a wonderful correspondent for Fox News, she is following Rashida Tlaib, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, member of the squad, who's been, you know, vehemently anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. She's following her through the corridor before she gets on an elevator that only staff is allowed on. And she's asking her a very simple question, basically whether she will condemn some of the worst atrocities of Hamas, such as beheading infants. Listen to what Congresswoman Tlaib says, or rather, does not say.
Terrorists have cut off babies' heads and burned children alive. Do you support Israel's rights to defend themselves against this brutality?
We're just going to go through here.
You can't comment about Hamas terrorists chopping off babies' heads? Congresswoman, do you have a comment on Hamas terrorists chopping off babies' heads? You have nothing to say about Hamas terrorists chopping off babies' heads? Do you condone what Hamas has done, chopping off babies' heads, burning children alive, raping women in the street? You have no comment about children's heads being chopped off?
Tries to block her.
Congressman, why do you have the Palestinian flag outside your office if you do not condone what Hamas terrorists have done to Israel? Do Israeli lives not matter to you?
That is absolutely insane. That is on a number of fronts. First of all, you're a congresswoman for the United States. And she could have easily said, of course, that's horrible. Even if you don't like that it's Fox News or you don't like that they're confronting you in the hallway, which is very, very regular in D.C., by the way. Correspondents always try to create gaggles, as they call them, around members of Congress as they go from one building to the other. It's very regular, very routine. You cannot muster a simple, of course I don't condone that. Of course I don't condone babies' heads being chopped off. You can't muster a single word. And then you have a staffer who's running block on Jackie Heinrichs to allow you to escape through an elevator. The only thing that could lead me to believe is that she does condone and that she's fine with it. Because why would you not just say? Of course not. And sure, there are, you know, you can have a more detailed conversation and debate and disagreement around the Israeli government and Israeli policies. That's different. We're talking about babies' heads being chopped off. And I also, Bill Malusian with Fox, eagle-eyed, and he sent out a tweet that really puts this in perspective. So back in 2019, during the quote-unquote kids in cages, you know, fiasco, where everybody was accusing President Donald Trump at the time of being absolutely awful toward immigrants and their children who were coming up illegally through the southern border. Well, Rashida Tlaib and the squad, during a congressional hearing, Bill Malusian shared the picture. In 2019, Representative Rashida Tlaib got emotional at a hearing on migrant children being separated from their parents at the border and called it traumatic and inhumane. And in the picture, she's sobbing, wiping tears from her face, absolutely sobbing. He goes on to say, today she had no comment and no reaction when asked about Israeli children being beheaded by Hamas terrorists. Think about that. Think about that. She is sobbing, crying, wiping tears from her eyes about how traumatic and inhumane it was for the children of migrants to be put in holding facilities where they were getting food, they were getting water. Was it the epitome of comfort? Probably not. Do I particularly agree with the practice? No. But you couldn't muster even a word of condemnation when asked whether you were opposed to terrorists chopping off the heads of babies, raping women in the street, many of them young women. If that is not enough to show you the depths, the absolute depths of depravity for this Congresswoman and the political grandstanding that she showed in 2019. She doesn't care about kids. She doesn't care about immigrant kids. She doesn't care about Israeli kids. All she cares about is her own ideology. If that, I wish something like that was enough to get her removed from office. It's one of the most stunning pieces of video that I have seen. All right, really quickly, some credit. Are we giving credit to Karine Jean-Pierre today?
Well, actually, it's yesterday because yesterday. Today I'm okay. Seeing reports of things she said, and I don't know. We might talk about some of those tomorrow.
Oh no, but okay. But well, this is the video from yesterday. Fits. But mm-hmm. I was actually, I don't know, shocked is the word, but glad that at least some Democrat could condemn unequivocally what was happening to Israelis.
What is the president's message to members of Congress who seem to be equating the Hamas terror attack with actions that were previously taken by Israel?
Look, here's the thing, and which congressional members?
Well, there have been some members of Congress who have called for a ceasefire, and they have not gone as far as backing the administration's call for support for Israel.
So look, I've seen some of those statements this weekend, and we're going to continue to be very clear. We believe they're wrong. We believe they're repugnant, and we believe they're disgraceful. Our condemnation belongs squarely with terrorists who have brutally murdered, raped, kidnapped hundreds of Israelis. There can be no equivocation about that. There are not two sides here. There are not two sides.
Yeah, and I actually, that should be just a matter of course to say that and to push back against statements from members of the president's political party, but I am glad when I see it because it happens so rarely, and for them to say there's not, you can't both sides this issue, and certainly to respond the way that Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib did, I hope nobody would condone that. Okay, we'll get to questions and comments coming up, but first I've been talking about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic. I started the program around this time last year. I got fantastic results. I lost almost 30 pounds before the end of the year. Felt absolutely wonderful for my big day to walk down the aisle toward the man of my dreams. Although I did acknowledge that in that dress, I have not one but two corsets on. But I still looked
That's
fabulous and
fabric.
Felt great. Yeah, felt great on my big day. So if you have been hearing me talk about Eastside Weight Loss Clinic, you've been contemplating it, you just don't know if you're ready to commit, just start by using by doing a simple 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team. You can do it virtually. You can do the whole program virtually. And you just talk through with them any questions you might have about whether the program is right for you before you actually commit. It doesn't cost you anything. It'll just take a little bit of time. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. All right, questions, comments. And I just want to note again, we had an issue with our Patreon posting, so you might have gotten the notice that we were going live. I tried to do a secondary one, so you might have actually gotten two notices that we were going live today, because for some reason it was only letting me schedule things today. So that's what was going on there and why we delayed the start of the show a little bit, to try to get folks from Patreon notified as to what was going on. All right, Bill Biz with a $20 super chat. Brandy, it's wonderful to hear that Miranda is doing better and great to see you back on the show. Yeah, and Miranda walked a little today. She, with help and stuff, of course, and she still got breathing help, but she walked a little bit, which was good because she'd been obviously stationary for so long. So that's good news. Great to be back on the show, although I will admit I'm a little emotionally exhausted and tired, and Nicole can attest to that. Mm-hmm. But here we are. We're doing the show, and we're glad to be back. Bill says, regarding the Bainbridge Island School District, both public and private, just as woke as Seattle, if not more so. On Bainbridge, Vicky Berg says, that's why all those DEI directors should lose their worthless jobs. Yeah, some of these, the title that woman had, like, they have staff members specifically designed, like, for an equity lens. And it's like, come on. I mean, aren't you guys short on teachers everywhere? It's weird to me. Brandon Robillard said they should have never let them set root within their, what?
I think that he's saying they've planted their, like, they've already infiltrated the school, like the classrooms, and they've, like, with allowing it with these previous issues like BLM and abortion, they've already been.
They should have never let them set root within their garden. A little metaphor. I don't get it, Brandon.
I think
Sorry.
It's root, garden, classroom.
Yes,
got
I
it.
I get it. Okay, I get it. We still love you, though. Jason said, I suspect the reason they were careful is because this issue is complex from an equity lens, whereas other issues are not. On the one side, you have Islamophobia against people of Palestine. On the other, there is vicious anti-Semitism against Israelis. The school probably has a lot of Jewish and Muslim families, and threading this needle to avoid alienating either group or encouraging the aforementioned bigotries is not easy. And I do understand that. And that's why I said that I was fine. I was fine with the initial email saying, hey, this is not a time to argue about the long history of Israeli-Palestinian relations. It's not a time to dive into what happened. I agreed with that email. My issue I took was the fact that they have so forcefully taken political positions on other things that could absolutely alienate families and students. Absolutely. I mean, you've got kids there that have, you know, first of all, white kids. I mean, how many times have we, like, seen in school districts when you talk about racial issues, white kids being excluded, feeling alienated? I mean, down in Olympia, they had a group where white kids weren't allowed in it. And then also on policing issues, which the Bainbridge Island superintendent has spoken out about a lot in emails to students and or emails to staff and parents. You don't think if you're a kid at the Bainbridge Island School District who has a police officer as a parent that you might feel a little bit uncomfortable and a little bit alienated. So to me, it's about, okay, either you're going to talk about hot button political issues or you're not. On Andrew Lewis, Matthew Cook says, Brandy, on the FOIA request, is there a required time frame to provide the requested documents? Are there fines or ramifications for not doing so? So technically, no, there's not a required time frame, but I think it has to be within reason. So there are certainly avenues that I could approach if I felt as if it was not being fulfilled in a timely manner. And I don't know if we're going to do any of that. I think that I would have a hard time arguing that 3 months from, what is it? So June, July, August, so 3.5 months so far, that would be a time to take some sort of extraordinary measures to force their hand. Although I, from experience, know that that's a long period of time when it comes to such a narrow public records quest. I have tried to push back. In fact, I reached out to another council member and asked, hey, is this normal? This is what I'm experiencing here. When you guys get requests for records, how long does it take you to respond? And so I've been trying to work some back channels there. JC says, I wonder what would happen if you requested the emails and cell records of the people who are facilitating the FOIA request. That might have to be a step that we take. And again, I'm not accusing anyone of wrongdoing. I am simply letting you know that we have been in pursuit of this information. We have not been able to get it. I think it's critical that we get it and see what's there before the general election. There might be nothing there. This might be a completely moot point, and it really might be that he changed his mind at the last minute because people showed up and yelled at him. So I'm not saying that there's something there, that there's a there there, but I'm saying that we deserve to know, and we should have gotten those records in a more timely manner. All right, Leah says, oh, Andrew Lewis, so young and naive. I almost feel bad for him. I don't know how old Andrew Lewis is. Nicole, are you going to Google that? Do you think he's younger or older than me?
Younger.
Oh, okay.
I think he's pretty young.
But I don't know. Nicole will be on that.
Let's see.
On Rashida Tlaib, Alicia says, her lack of response is sickening. How do people like her keep getting reelected? I just don't understand. Absolutely egregious.
He's 33.
Ah, 33. Yes, he is 1 year younger mm-hmm. than me. Wait, no. Am I 35 now? Oh, when did that happen? Yeah. Okay, good. All right.
I'm glad you remembered there.
Yeah. Oh, man. Rick Johnson says the left likes to lob words such as racist and bigot on a regular basis, but here we have actual confirmed anti-Semites and racists, yet no condemnation or public outcry, and they continue to reelect them. And there is condemnation. There is a public outcry in the sense that across social media, et cetera. And you had Karine Jean-Pierre, not specifically, I don't think she's reacting to this video clip because I don't know which one came first, but there does have to be. Can you imagine if the equivalent of that was happening from a Republican, the outcry in the media, if other Republicans did not unequivocally condemn it in the strongest possible terms? And so I think that the media would certainly be harder, not just that this was a Fox News clip. I mean, Fox News is obviously being hard on her, but what about other outlets looking at that and saying, she can't condemn children being beheaded? What's wrong with this woman? Is she fit for Congress? I don't think she'd be given as much leniency to do what she did or did not do if she were a Republican. All right. Thank you for the questions and comments today. We'll get to our closing sanity check. Closing. Ugh. Can't talk today. Closing.
It's been a morning.
I was just about to have a meltdown when Patreon wouldn't work earlier. I have no emotional energy for anything.
Yeah.
Except for
we were talking
what about, I need to do.
Yeah, we were talking about this, but I feel like your wedding seems like ages ago.
I know.
The last couple weeks have been so crazy that it just seems like ages ago that you got married.
Yeah, and I'm sure it won't be this way, but the joy from the wedding certainly was like immediately followed by just the absolute like fear and mm-hmm. sadness. And so I just feel like Mike and I haven't really had time. And Miranda, how could you do this to us? Take away our joy from our wedding? No, just haven't had time to sort of settle in, because then it was like immediately like Miranda was sick and we were in Miami and it was just, so anyway.
Yeah.
Deep breaths. And then my public records requests aren't being fulfilled.
For the love.
anyway, so we'll get to our closing sanity check in a moment. And it's a positive one today, because I feel like we need a positive sanity check to show that there is actually some sanity left in the world and in Washington State. But before that, can your retirement portfolio keep up with inflation? That is a critical question right now. If you are just starting to save for retirement, or if you're nearing retirement, our friends over at Know Your Risk Radio and Bulwark Capital, Zach Abraham, they are as concerned as the rest of us are about the state of the economy, about the house of cards that the Biden administration is building with Bidenomics and printing trillions of dollars. And Zach Abraham joined us to talk about really the concern about people's retirement portfolios and how they're positioned for risk once Bidenomics comes crashing down.
We think the world is going insane. We think that the world is propped up on all kinds of, you know, we know, propped up printed money. And you're playing a game that has to end badly, right? Now, when it ends, when you hear all these prognosticators financially talking about when it ends, it kind of reminds me of when God's coming back. Nobody knows, right? But what it does mean is that you need a portfolio that can do two things. It can keep up with inflation and not get you buried. But also, when the inevitability of living and perpetuating an economy on printed money, when that inevitability comes to the fore, you need a portfolio that can stand up against anything, right?
Yeah, and I think it's worth reaching out to Zach Abraham and Bulwark Capital, go to knowyourriskradio.com just to go through that with them, to talk about, hey, here is where I am on my journey to retirement. Here's what my concerns are. Certainly inflation is one of them. And how can I make sure that I'm adequately protected from the risk involved in the current economy? So knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. And as always on Thursdays, Zach will join us on the show tomorrow. And I look forward to talking to him about, you know, one of the things that the markets really react to is what's happening nationally and globally and big political issues and what's happening in Israel. And so I think it's important to talk about that from the perspective of the impact on the financial markets as well. All right. Marysville has officially adopted a mandatory sentencing program for repeat offenders. Let's get to it in our closing sanity check. We talked about this proposal on the show a few weeks ago, and it is just common sense. It is absolutely sane to look at what's happening in cities across Washington State, particularly Western Washington, where you have individuals who are repeatedly committing what they call in Marysville public nuisance crimes, where you are repeatedly contributing to a lower quality of life in a city by the crimes that you are habitually committing. And what the city of Marysville proposed is, okay, let's have mandatory minimum sentences for people who are committing the same kinds of crimes like theft and public drug use 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. And at every threshold, there is a requirement that a judge sentence you to a minimum sentence when you are a habitual repeat offender. And I am happy to report the world of sanity is very glad to hear that Marysville has now adopted that proposal. According to the Everett Herald, Marysville adopts mandatory sentences for repeat public disorder. This is, and Marysville has, you know, I think really taken a common sense, and I like their mayor up there a lot, a common sense position on a lot of these issues, you know, pushed back against the misguided pursuit bill, tried to work in a bipartisan fashion with lawmakers in Snohomish County, state lawmakers, to fix that thing, tried to come up with a common sense fix to the Blake decision, which nullified our state's felony drug possession statute. And this is something that I hope every common sense jurisdiction in the state will do to try to protect law-abiding communities and law-abiding citizens from the repeat offenders who are bringing down the quality of life, who are hurting businesses, who are hurting people who are just going about their lives trying to do the right thing. So kudos to Marysville for showing us that there is still some sanity left in the world. That has been your sanity check for today, which I desperately needed. And that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We'll have our final live show of the week coming up tomorrow at noon, and then a wonderful episode of Sundays with Subscribers that will tease for you tomorrow for a live program. See you then.